This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Eli, I'm excited. I am so excited. Today, we have a truly remarkable guest joining us. Our guest is a multidisciplinary artist known for his powerful and thought-provoking work, and it is thought-provoking. His art spans painting, sculpture, and installations using found objects to make bold statements and contemporary and historical issues. Please welcome Kobe Kennedy. I start stumbling over my words because I really wanted to get into this conversation. I spent a lot of time just looking at your artwork, and it was, when they talk about true art being thought-provoking, Eli and I, we have a lot of questions about your work. But let's start with a little bit about who you are. You're brilliant.
Thank you. But
there's a reason for that.
Yes.
You got two parents. Talk to us about your upbringing a little bit.
Absolutely. It was, I just recently realized that I grew up in a bubble with two parents that were like just fully immersed in the arts world. You know, they were fully immersed in the Black arts movement from, the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I came up in that. And everything I am, I got from my mom and my dad. I always say that like everything I know about life, the universe, and everything comes from either my mom or the first two seasons of Miami Vice, because I can trace it all back to them. And my dad was the dean of the art department at Howard University. I grew up on the Howard University campus. I thought all kids had this experience, participating in nude figure drawings classes with college age people, just roaming the campus. I thought that was normal. And then my mom, professional artist in Washington, D.C., exhibiting, she taught. I was always up at Banneker High School, in the art department, and then art track and throughout the school all the way up to college. And then immediately I went off to Japan for 10 years. And so honestly, the first time I really interacted deeply with folks that weren't in that frame of mind, that art, pure gonzo art frame of mind, was when I got back to the States in the early 2000s. And I realized that, I'm not normal.
Now, you mentioned, in one of your pieces about your father picking cotton.
Yeah. My dad always used to tell us, he was like, whenever we messed up or were acting out or just being kids, he was like, gotta get y'all down south, get y'all on the cotton fields, learn you a little something. Because, he was born in New Jersey, but spent every summer for the first 14 years of his life, I think, down south on his family's sharecropping. He had the whole experiences. He hid under beds when he was a little kid from the Klan, because the Klan was riding through the town. Like, literally could see, it was like in the movies, could see the light of the Klan's torches having rallies in the woods on the other side of the fields, And all kinds of stuff, all the stories he's told me. Like, there's this whole life, me and my brother, as Northern Black folk, never got to experience and only saw in movies. But, it's a part of our DNA.
Yeah. So you've had quite a number of experiences, including you were a car designer for 10 years in Japan.
Yeah.
You also studied at Pratt.
Right.
You also, French people, excuse me, École Nationale Supérieure de Beaux-Arts in Paris.
Did he say that right?
I believe so, yeah.
The Italian said my accent in Italian is very good. It's a Milanese accent.
Yeah.
I don't want to embarrass myself. But,
I thought your accent was real Brooklyn.
Well, no, my accent in Italian is Milanese.
Yeah, I got you.
I was lucky.
It could be a Brooklyn accent. What do they know? All right. So that's a number of experiences. I can't imagine a lot of them really shape your artistic vision today.
Very much so. I mean, I've been extremely lucky to have experienced globally things that people, even in those indigenous countries, don't get to experience. I feel like experience builds everything. It's you can read about something, but until you've done it, it's a whole different ball game. And I used to say that I've been chased out of every continent on the planet except for Australia. But, and it's not just.
What do you mean chased down? Well, what are you doing? What's happening? What's happening?
Come you know, good, bad, and neutral experiences are great. For me, especially in my younger years, I learned a lot from adverse experiences. And being a 6 foot tall black dude with a dreadlock mohawk that stands up 2 feet off of your head, you know, I was like a lightning pole for people's neuroses, misconceptions. So everything from getting in fights in back alleys in Shanghai to getting AK-47s pulled on me in the airports in Cairo. The Cairo thing is just, I learned a lot in Cairo. You know, I was just brawls, fights. I barely made it out of there alive. And it's not anything to brag about. It's just like I've experienced for the last 40 years a wide assortment of what it means to be American in the contemporary age, what it means to be black and Western in the contemporary age.
It informs your art, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm thinking about what you're saying and looking at your experience with sharecropping and then now all, you know, throughout the diaspora, so to speak. Can you talk to us about that tension and how that was channeled into your work?
There's a rubber band effect. You know, it's like you experience things that are immediate to you, you know, whether it's the cops, like whether it's in, whether it's, you know, speaking from my experience, whether it's St. Louis being taken down a dark hallway in third precinct, I think it was, and put in a dark room and being threatened that you will not leave this room walking by a cop that just arrested you for absolutely nothing, you know?
Experience in Greece.
Yeah, that very...
Send me to prison.
Yeah. You know, that very immediate black American local grew up with experience. And then you go out and you leave and you see the dynamics on all sides of the scales that not just you represent out in the world, but what people are going through out in the world, you know, and it gives you this perspective. And then you even go further, like with my mom, she was all into quantum physics. And so she, at 6 years old, she destroyed any semblance of common sense I would have by introducing me to theory of relativity, you know, with one statement.
So mom sounds real brilliant.
Oh, she's brilliant.
I mean, yeah, because quantum physics is fantastic when you talk about spiritual things, right?
When they discovered, what was it, the quark and the God particle, she was just like, oh, I'm painting.
Unified field theory that goes along
exactly.
With that as well.
And then you bounce back. You go all the way out there, right? And then you bounce back to the immediate where you are and you see all of what you thought you knew, what's familiar, the quotidian stuff that you have to deal with in a different way. Now, I even see, you know, police brutality in a different way after experiencing that and more throughout the globe.
Your mother also talked about monsters being real, right?
Yeah.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're having a fascinating conversation with artist Kobe Kennedy. Now, Eli, you can go on.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, no, actually, there's two things came to mind before we go into that, to the monsters. When you talked about this experience, all those experiences, good, bad, and different, whatever it is, that makes your art really powerful and rich, right? The other thing, it reminds me of a quote from Walter Benjamin was talking about him studying text. And he compared like the difference between reading a text and rewriting it as going over a landscape in a plane as opposed to walking it. So anyways, let's go back to the monster thing. So she took you outside. She had this conversation about monsters, about horses.
It was 6 years old. I was 6 years old at 605 Gresham Place, Washington, D.C., right across from Howard University football field. And I asked my mom, I was like, hey, mom, are monsters real? And she was holding my brother Campbell, who was like three or something. And she was like, oh yes, Kobe, yes, they're very real. And I remember, and it wasn't in these words, but I remember it was of this feeling of like, that is heavy dump on a six-year-old. Like, why would you do that? Why would you say that? Nobody else says that. And so she was like...
Unless you're trying to discipline kids, because the boogeyman was real for me.
Like the boogeyman.
Well, you could see it that way. Yeah, right. When I heard that, I didn't see it that way. Yeah, I see it as a punishment. I see it like, you know...
And see, that's the thing. My parents never lied to me. You know, like, we knew about the tooth fairy, Santa Claus, the whole thing.
That.
But she was saying, she was like, you know, Kobe, if you came from a place that had no horses and you came here and you saw a horse, that horse would seem like a monster to you. And I was just like, oh. So from that day on, everything depends. Like everything, there's no definiteness, there's no solids, there's no way of doing things. It all depends on these factors and these perceptions. And that's where I was thinking from 6 years old. And I do say this, you know, it destroyed my common sense because I feel like common sense is just rules that we all agree on, you know, and this is the way that things are. And I was like, there is no one way.
Yeah, I wanted to, you talked about police. And then I'm thinking about that Khalif Browder, the box. Can you talk to us about that? Because that, to me, was powerful. The story of Khalif Browder was extremely powerful.
Yeah.
And then your work on that, it was silent. You know, that's what came to me. It just felt, yeah.
Yeah, the... You know, from a lot of my experiences, I have never and hopefully will never experience what it's like to be abducted and imprisoned and having every single semblance of my, not just free will, but my agency of my self-identity taken away. And the closest I've come have been experiences like... St. Louis, you know, like being held overnight, being held, you know, things that happened overseas. But when Khalif Browder's story came to me, it struck me to the gut because
I know. It hit, man.
You know, yeah, I hate being blamed for things I don't do.
Yes.
You know, like I hate it. And to have that happen on that level, you know, and to lose that much of your life and to not just to lose that much of your life. It's like
with the trauma to kill you. The trauma killed
you.
It just killed you.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the video they had of what he had to go through. He was thrown in with the wolves. You know, it's not like you're just taken off the street and now you have time to contemplate and work for your freedom. It's like you have to survive, you know, being that I had had just a cursory taste of the beginnings of what something like that could ever feel, I wanted to take what Khalif went through and impart that to the public, to the viewers of the public sculpture that I made, so that they could have a sense, a semblance of, you know, this is going on here in our country now. You know, this dystopian, we see this, you know, us walking around here, we see this stuff in science fiction films, you know, but it's happening now under our nose, like right next to us. And I wanted to share that with the public in a way that impacted them and gave them moments to think of about their own freedom. So I made the box, and the box is the size of a solitary confinement cell, which Khalif spent hundreds of days back to back in. And it's plexiglass, you can see through it, and it has a part of his story etched onto the side of it. And it invites people to first be interested in what this object is, and then on their realization of what this object and this space that it's representing did to a human being, a boy, a kid. Their empathy, you know, they can imagine themselves stuck in this thing. And what even just that part of his story, what that would do to their lives. And is the piece was really about encouraging empathy of whoever passed by it. And, you know, as far as, you know, the piece and Khalif, the thing that struck me so much was Khalif's resiliency, you know, to make it through that.
I thought about that, but then the tragic end of the story.
I remember I said...
Because you did celebrate, his resiliency, but 2 years later...
Somebody got mad at me. They were saying, resiliency, you're being so offensive. I think it's on the Instagram post. You're being so offensive. You know, like, he died. No, he can, you know, there's no resiliency here. I was like, he made it through that.
But
like,
I got what you meant.
He made it through being thrown in with the wolves. He made it through, like, having to fight to live and got out. And he said, that, you know, on the documentary, you know, he was saying that he's not going to let people define who he is. You know, he's going to get out and not just set the record straight, but like, let it be known. And then being harassed by the cops even after that, like, they just did not let him him heal.
Right.
And then the final effect is what this entire institutionalized structure did to him, you know? But like his resiliency at making it, you know, making it through that, you know, and getting to the other side. And all he needed, you know.
That was the problem though, the getting to the other
you know?
Side.
Once you're out to the other side, it's the damage that nobody sees that does it to you, you know?
It sure does.
One of the things that we've done recently is the Reach sculpture
in Chicago's O'Hare. That's fabulous.
Airport.
What was the inspiration?
Inspiration for Reach was, you know, looking at, for me, because we came to it from our own places and like we put everything in the pile and, you know, in discussion, we found all kinds of new aspects and ways of looking at human connection, at looking at the importance of travel. You know, not just like, oh, I'm gonna go get on a plane, but literally what it did for me, traveling the globe changed my entire life, you know? For Khalif Browder, he was about to go off on this travel program that would have done worlds of good for him, but he couldn't. It was too late. He couldn't make it. Like that, the importance of this thing of seeing new perspectives and all of that. And for the Reach, we were looking in history of how that's depicted.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to the remarkable. Now I'm really getting superlative now, but it's a fascinating conversation. Kobe Kennedy, you were speaking about the Reach.
Yeah, for the Reach public sculpture, looking at. It's a transport hub, you know, Chicago O'Hare Airport, and like thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people travel through this thing weekly, monthly, yearly, going places, doing things. The world has become so much smaller, and Reach. Part of it that hits me is like it harkens back to an era when the world was much bigger. Mm-hmm. And traveling, going out of your home base, your home hamlet, your home whatever, was kind of going to the other side of the world. And new cultures, the unknown, you know? And making it that size harkens back to when travelers would come home, like at the Colossus mm-hmm. Rhodes, you know, like the Colossus, these magnificent sculptures that were erected in the form of human beings that were a welcoming beacon to the traveler when they returned home. They knew they were home. They knew they were safe because there was a time when being home and being safe meant your survival. And in a way, you know, in a lot of contexts, you know, touching on stuff that we've already been talking about, that's how it is today in a way. And people just don't see it that way. Actually experiencing for so many years the dangers and the challenges that are out there when you leave what's familiar, when you leave the safety that you have. I drew on that, you know, and the two arms reaching out to.
That's the one where your feedback wasn't quite as. The feedback wasn't as intense, correct?
As other stuff, projects I may have worked on. The arms that reach out and touch each other are, there's a lot in there. It's
now,
wild.
You've also done video work too, you know, and I'm thinking about the Ballad of the Mulatto. What inspired that?
Colorism.
Ah.
My family.
Ah.
My family it's always felt like the Montagues and the Capulets. It's always felt like a tale of two cities. You know, my mom's side of the family is super light. My dad's side is super dark.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's side of the family has honestly benefited off of all
light skin privilege.
Light skin privilege. All the stuff that is bequeathed.
Oh, sorry. Hello.
Yeah. All the stuff that is bequeathed to the lighter shade globally, but very much in this country in the last century, you know. And my dad's family has received all of the weight of being dark skinned. My dad was the first person in his lineage to go to college. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, like, got some heat for it.
Does this persist in your family today as things have moved on, the whole colorism piece?
Well, I mean, it's not even about them having beef. It's about how we're treated in society and what that bequeaths us. So when you look at our two families, yeah, the eventuality of that carries on, you know, like living in this country, you know, this is the, I mean, people forget that we're living in a sci-fi movie. This country is one of the most dystopian countries to ever exist on the planet Earth. You know, like we've put Rome to shame. We've put, you know, any things that we look back and see those as barbaric, you know, and everything from how this country came about to what it is today. Without going into, we could talk right. for yes. days on that. But for me, I wanted to illustrate that. And that's a thing that has been kind of ongoing and percolating in my work since, you know, I very much jumped into it with the, that whole series is In the Service of a Villain.
Right.
And it's about colorism and attacking it head on. The, and getting heat for that. Talking about getting heat for work, you know, like got heat for that. People are talking about, well, why are we talking about colorism? Didn't we somebody said this, didn't Spike Lee sum that up in
never summed
school
up.
Days?
This is evolving. This yeah. is a conversation that doesn't stop in our community.
Yeah. I was like, we deal right. with it right now. You know, we deal with it right now. And, you know, like, yeah. Just to pivot on what you were saying before, you know, like working in conjunction with other artists, you
yes.
know, it was a big pleasure to work alongside artists on the Embrace. Mm-hmm. Having a hand in, you know, the parts of that project, you know, it's like anything that you're a part of in any way, shape, or form, no matter how much or how little, you kind of feel dear to. Mm-hmm. And I can definitely tell you that when the full ire of Black Twitter came down on that project, the opening weekend, it was illuminating.
Yeah. How so?
Well, it's like you work, you contribute to a piece, you contribute to an idea, you contribute to whatever, and you see it in a certain way. And it's very interesting to see all the different ways that people take it. And once you put something out into the public, the public's going to take it the way that they take it. And that's a lot of fun for a lot of artists. You know, it's enriching because it's almost like a collaboration. Like you make a person makes the work, it's out there, and then the way it's accepted is what finishes the work itself. And to that, along with a lot of other work that I've either helped out on, had a part in, or done, you know, complete myself, that's received a lot of flack on a large level. For me, it's really enriching because it teaches me so much about people's perception, like groupthink and all of this stuff. I almost got canceled one time. I remember the good swath of the Jewish art world came at me.
Let's talk about that.
I did a piece that was talking about Black Hebrew Israelites.
Okay.
You know, people I've grown up around for my entire life. And it's this thing about identity and constructing an identity and being so stripped of an identity mm-hmm. that you have to piece together your own image, your own existence, your own who you are
right.
from the detritus of civilization. You take what you can get and put it together. You know, that's kind of where, like, for us, that's where soul food came from. That's where, like, so much music came from. Mm-hmm. And I did this piece that was commenting on the Black Hebrew Israelite and how, you know, so many of them, you know, speaking freely, so many of them picked it up in detention centers, in prison, how so many of them were stripped down by society to nothing and built themselves up with this image of adopting the Israelite, adopting the Hebrew traditions or faiths, and then like twisting it into this thing of their own. And honestly, I mean, it comes from getting in fights with a lot of them mm-hmm. over the years. Right. And it was a question of like, who are you? What are you doing? Like where are you going with?
This is the guys you see on the street corners.
Mm-hmm. Screaming on yeah. everybody.
Okay,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah. So I made this faceless yeah. beast that it actually tattooed all over himself images and icons of culture. Had Sambo mm-hmm. Stenciled on on his shoulder, had the American flag scrawled on his side of his face, and then he painted the Star of David on his face. And the question, the audio that ran over it was that McCarthy era, are you now or have you ever been, mm-hmm. you know, a communist? But it's like, right. are you now or have you ever been what, mm-hmm. you know? And posted it up, and it was an avalanche for about 3 days. Just people just like, you're anti-Semitic, you're this, you're that, mm-hmm. you're that. Mm-hmm. And it taught me a lot about image and what image can do.
We walk a tightrope, though, when it comes to you. I imagine if you're going to do profound art, mm-hmm. you are walking, there's that hazard.
Well, but this breaks that question about the balance, and you talked about this, right. between, mm-hmm. you know, being controversial and also being in the public and also being commercial. I mean, it's always a juggling uh-huh. act.
Yeah? And are you really critiquing something or are you perpetuating it? When you do things like I have done in the past by critiquing by example, you know, if we continue down this road, this is what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times in the past, I've found that I have to hold I've had to hold the viewer's hand and walk them through where my work is going. Because if not, then a lot of times they'll take it as just perpetuating what I'm talking about.
You have a very unusual art practice, a combination of physical, digital. You do very mm-hmm. interesting materials like Kevlar and Rust. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the...
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my first career was an industrial designer. That's what took me out to Japan to do car design. I was doing concept cars for Honda for years. And then with a partner of mine, we left and started our own product car design company in Italy when I was living in Italy. And we did projects for... We did projects for Alfa Romeo, proposals for Ferrari. We were about to... redo the entire comeback of Di Tommaso. They're bringing back Di Tommaso, the Pantera. Any car nut is going to know this. And we were going to do the entire line, but then they went under. And so I've had this huge career of industrial design that came before I was double dog dared to jump into fine art as a full time. And I've wanted to marry those two worlds, you know, take the industrial materials and take film and video and filmmaking and all the things that I've done and see what happens when you smash them together. You know, right now I'm very much using bulletproof Kevlar and painting with rust, and steel finds its way in. And all of that comes from, you know, it's not just material. It comes from my experiences in Washington, D.C. when bulletproof vests started appearing in our neighborhoods back in like the early 90s. And taking these charged materials and working with it.
Well, I must say, you know, you must know that you've had an amazing life, right? Even with all that you have to confront, being African-American male, you've been all over the world. And your art is extremely impactful.
Thank you.
Very, very impactful. So this is, you know, we've got to have Kobe back, Eli, because we
For
didn't get through. We didn't get through a lot, but you are fascinating. Wow. I just love this guy. So
thank you.
You know, actually, looking at your art helped me to understand art, like what it's supposed to do. But we've got to wrap it up. So, to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Artmoves with a Z. You can also listen to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kuslansky. Find some art that moves you and share it. Thank you.